This is Life Mint, and you're listening to the Editor's Podcast with me, Preetha Banerjee, and Mint's editor, R. Sukumar.
So the two stories from the Indian startup ecosystem that really made headlines recently are that of Flipkart outselling Amazon in December-January and Snapdeal's dwindling cash reserve. To me, the picture looks contrasting because though the valuation of both the startups have taken a mark down, Flipkart's news is optimistic, whereas Snapdeal's picture still looks very gloomy.
What is your insight?
I think I want to look at this a little differently, right? First of all, neither of the startups has really taken a markdown yet. They'll take a markdown when a down round happens. The thing is, both of them are trying to raise money, and the valuation at which investors are willing to come in is much lower than their peak valuations. One of them will definitely take a down round. And then, of course, after the first company does it, a spate of companies will do it. I think what we are seeing right now is a situation where most of these guys know that their valuation is off their peak. They want to raise money, but they don't want to be the first company to do a down round for a variety of reasons. I mean, it's always tough for the first company to do it. But then once one company does it, everyone else will do it. I'm not so worried about monthly sales, right? Also, because as we pointed out, the monthly sales for both these companies, Flipkart and Amazon, and they're neck and neck. And I think that's the way one would like to see it, the fact that they're neck and neck. Mm. It's strongly dependent on who gets a nice exclusive deal from one of the new mobile phones that is launching. And that is, seems to be the sole distinguishing factor between who edges out the rival and just moves up marginally ahead. The good news from Flipkart's side, however, is that there seems to be a turnaround of sorts that is happening. Things seem to be stabilizing a little bit, which is great. Snapdeal, of course, has been in constant trouble for quite some time. I think what has happened is that usually when there is significant competition from two companies, it's usually not one of them who gets hurt, but the third company that gets hurt. And that's clearly what's happened in this case, because Snapdeal was very close to Flipkart at one point in time. They saw themselves as rivals. The founders saw themselves as peers. But I think Snapdeal has since lost significant ground. They've tried a variety of things to position themselves differently. Very difficult to do in this market, right? I mean, because I don't think it's a market where consumers are still brand loyal. And if your sole distinguishing factor is going to be which mobile phone you can offer or what level of discount you can offer, I don't think it's going to help anyone. So the overall startup scenario is still a little fraught. Everyone's focus has shifted to costs. So they're not hiring as aggressively as they did. They're not hiring the kind of people that they did because they all went after these really high-flying professionals from the consulting firms and from large consumer package companies and consumer durables companies, some even hired from the Valley. So you're going to see a little bit of conservatism in that. And everyone is trying to raise money at almost the same level at which they did. So, you know, the list is long. Ola, Flipkart, Snapdeal, Zomato. I mean, these are all unicorns or near unicorns. They will have to take a down round. That much is clear. Who will do it? When will that happen? We'll have to wait and watch, but it's going to happen in the next few months. And then once one of them does it, everyone else will do it. And you will see a semblance of rationality returning to this whole overheated sector. Because right now, sure, they're focusing on costs, but all of them have this little shred of hope that they'll still manage to raise money at a level at which they did last time. Now, this is also an interesting thing because look at it from the investor's perspective. If you look at e-commerce marketplaces, there's, of course, Amazon. But then in India, you have, when you look at Indian companies, and I use Indian within, you know, oral quotation marks simply because Flipkart, for instance, is incorporated in Singapore. But if you look at companies like Flipkart and Snapdeal and even Shopcluse, why did investors fund the second company, the third company? And the reason is no one wants to be left out. This is a proxy for retail in India, right? You can't directly invest in retail in India because multi-brand retail is close to foreign investment. So if you didn't invest in Flipkart, you had to invest in Snapdeal. If you didn't invest in either of them because the valuations became too high, then you had to find a third one to invest in, which is why someone went and invested in Shopcluse. My sense is investors have money, but they've turned conservative. But all it's going to take is for two or three new investors to come in and say, I want to have a piece of this pie. And then these companies could actually raise money at the same valuation at which they did in the previous round.
Right.
I have a feeling that the companies also believe that this is a possibility, fairly slim possibility, but it remains a possibility. Mm-hmm. We'll have to wait and watch. So it's an interesting scenario. Next couple of months are going to be extremely interesting. We are going to be seeing a lot more stories on valuation and down rounds and things like that. As far as monthly sales go, I personally, to be quite honest, these stories leave me cold. Right.
And I've observed that there's a lot of debate around the fact that calling the companies like Flipkart, that have been here for a considerable amount of time, startups. So, I mean, I was personally very curious.
They're 10 years old.
Yeah.
Would you call a 10-year-old company a startup? I don't know. It's a good question. When do you stop calling Google a startup?
Exactly.
Right. I think if my memory serves me right, many of the US companies, everyone stopped calling them startups when they went public. Now, that could be a milestone.
Yeah.
But you're right. You could be large. You don't need to go for a listing. You could be privately held. There are privately held companies in India which are 70, 80 years old, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, maybe even 100 years old.
Yeah.
So when do you stop calling a company a startup? I, quite honestly, haven't paid attention to it. Easier to put them all together and call them a startup, right?
Right. Okay, so moving ahead, India had just started to move on from the Tata mystery battle when another boardroom coup, I mean, gripped the nation. And this time it's at Infosys. As I look at it, Infosys seems to have fewer dirty linen to wash in public. But, I mean, why don't you walk us through this issue as you perceive it?
Okay, first of all, the Tata story is not over, right? I mean, one part of it is over. But there's a legal aspect to it because the NCLT will decide whether it wants to admit the original plea of the Mistry companies alleging mismanagement. And in all fairness, when a shareholder with 18.4% stake alleges mismanagement and oppression of minority shareholders by the majority shareholders, I think in the interests of justice and fairness, I'm not speaking about the merit of the complaint or the accusation, but in the interests of justice and fairness, NCLT must admit it and hear the plea. So I think they will admit it. So which means, and then if the mystery companies lose that round, they'll probably appeal. So this is something that's going to go all the way to the top court in the land. So the legal battle, long and messy legal battle, is ahead of the Tata Group. That's on one side. Let's look at what's happened at Infosys. Infosys, there are multiple issues. I think at one level, and this is the level at which it's been portrayed in the press and everyone finds it easier to believe it at this level because of Mr. Narayan Murthy's personality. Mm. Narayan Murthy, for those who don't know, the original founder of Infosys, along with six other engineers. Very, very focused on details, tremendous micromanager. Clearly, he has some issues with letting go. Has very strong beliefs on, he's lived his life a particular way, he's managed the company a particular way. So obviously there's that hangover, he probably wants other people to do it. That's at one level, and this is the level at which it's been portrayed and other things. But there are also other issues at Infosys that have come out and to which we don't yet have answers. And what are these issues? The first one is CEO pay. Now, CEO pay is a global issue. So this is not, sure, at one level, this could be Mr. Murthy and some of the other founders feeling, oh, we didn't pay ourselves as much, why is this guy paying himself? Sure, maybe. And again, this is the level at which it's been portrayed widely outside. But at the end of the day, I think CEO compensation, it's a global issue, right? I mean, there are companies around the world which are wrestling with this issue. How much is too little? How much is too much? What was the decision based on? How transparent was the decision? And clearly in those areas, I don't think Infosys has given all the explanations that it needs to give. The second issue really has to do with the Panaya acquisition. And there have been all sorts of accusations flying around of things not being all right with this acquisition. We have to find out what happened during this acquisition, right? I mean, some of these reports have come out which allege that one of the founders was a former SAP person who was Vishal Sikka's mentor when he was working at SAP. There have been rumors that I've personally heard of some of the shareholders being related to Mr. Sikka, and none of this is true, right? At least most of it is not true, to the best of my knowledge. But the fact is there are these rumors and there are these wild allegations. These again surfaced during the recent controversies. So I think it's in Infosys' best interest for the board to find out what happened and put those facts in the public domain. There's a third issue, which has to do with the severance package of the former CFO. And now, of course, the chairman, Mr. Seshasayee, has said this is a learning experience and they have learned to put severance in the contract and not be subjective about it, which is fine. But what we want to know is who signed off on it? Was it the board? Was it presented as a fait accompli to the board by the CEO or by someone else, by the general counsel, whoever? What happened? And why was this amount so significant? Mm. Right? I mean, it's not significant from the global point of view, but 23 crore or 17 crore, which was the original amount agreed to be paid, was very significant. And then it was subsequently reduced to 5 crore. Okay. These are not new issues, right? I mean, Mint has been writing about exactly these issues since April last year. But they've obviously blown up. The founders are clearly not happy for a variety of reasons. Part of it could be this whole Mr. Murthy finding it difficult to let go and all these things. But part of it is also the fact that these issues that we just discussed, namely the Panaya acquisition, Vishal's pay, and Rajiv Bansal's severance, are significant issues. I think there would be significant issues in any company anywhere in the world, right? Mm-hmm. So I think, again, I don't want to go into magnitude of issues, but to my mind, these are very substantial issues that have been raised. I don't want to compare these to the issues that have been raised in the Tata Group, because that's another story. But I think these are substantial issues that have been raised, issues to which we don't have answers. So I'm not sure that this will end here. I have a feeling that we will see more of it going forward.
Next, I mean, we go a little deep into talking about the health of the IT sector in itself. So, I mean, while the Donald Trump's H-1B visa regulations were initially seen
again, this is related, right? Yeah. At a time when IT companies are not doing well, would you pay your CEO as much as you did, right?
I mean, it's very mysterious. Yeah. So, I mean, the visa regulations were initially seen as a death knell. But now, you know, I mean, there are stories coming up and people are more optimistic. They're trying to look at it as a glass half full instead of empty. So what do you think about it?
No, I know there are people who are giving them advice on how they should serve the local market and things like that. I mean, let's get real, okay, about various things. 60 to 65% of the revenue of the Indian IT sector comes from the US. You can't directly transpose that onto India and say, oh, we have a huge market, we will get business from here. Not going to happen. The billing rates will be different. The paying capacities are different. It's not going to work. The US is an important market. There are, of course, people who are also saying this is an opportunity for Indian IT companies to get innovative and do things differently. I buy that. But it's not something where, you know, you snap your fingers and you become innovative, you launch successful products, you start doing high-end work in social media, analytics, cloud, Internet of Things, artificial intelligence, all these kind of things. The bigger and better Indian companies are trying to do things in these areas. But they're not there yet. So, and it's a long and tough journey to get there. So sure, I mean, this gives them an opportunity to focus a little more on those things, and they should focus. But the fact is, the US is important. You can't replace the US market with any other market anywhere in the world. Europe is anyway a mess. Japan and other parts are fairly small markets. Mm. Nor can you suddenly say my old business model is being changed and I'll become a different sort of company. Mm. Which probably explains why NASSCOM, which is the Indian Software Lobby Group, has not given a forecast for this year, which is, I mean, the first time I can recall, as long as I've been covering IT, that they've not given a forecast, which is frightening. What does it mean? It means fewer jobs. As such, the IT sector has stopped hiring significant numbers. There are millions of engineers whom we produce as a country every year. I have no idea where they're going to find jobs. At one point in time, the IT sector was the preferred employer. That's gone.
They're also moving a lot towards artificial intelligence. And I mean,
not a lot, a little bit. I mean
experimenting.
Experimenting, and they have some contracts in that area. But these are, again, I think the direction of your question, if I presume right, was the fact that if you move to platforms and artificial intelligence, it means you need fewer engineers,
fewer
right?
Jobs again.
Yeah, and again, fewer jobs, which is true. So the whole model is changing. So in this scenario for NASSCOM to not give a forecast is pretty frightening. But then I guess we don't know what's going to happen in the US, right? Mm. I mean, every time you think that you have some certainty on what's likely to happen, things change again, right? So you're not sure.
And I also wonder that if America was so much dependent on the Indian engineers, how are they going to function?
Again, I'm not sure that they are entirely dependent on Indian engineers to a certain extent, right? I mean, because this whole H-1B thing for specialized workers, yes, there are certain jobs that can only be performed by the specialists whom you're getting from other countries. The US probably doesn't have enough of them. But part of it is also definitely cost. And like I've said previously, I don't think all Indian companies can in equal measure put their hand on their hearts and say, we have never misused this, right? Many of them probably have. From the outsourcing point of view for customers in the US, it probably made sense to not look too closely at whether some of these jobs requiring really specialized skills could be performed by local engineers. Mm. Maybe they would have had to pay a local engineer much more. Mm. So cost definitely was one part of it. Mm. So I think just like Indian IT companies will have to figure out what's going to happen, the US will also have to figure out what is likely to happen if it closes its borders to skilled workers, right? And I mean, that's an issue that they'll have to address.
So moving on, the succession drama in Tamil Nadu is turning out to be something like a soap opera script. And in fact, economist Vivek Deep Roy very wittily touched upon this topic in his limerick this Tuesday. And he said that the sound of succession bears resemblance with secession. What is your point of view?
See, it's a limerick. Right, and Vivek's limericks are hilarious, right? I mean, he did one on Infosys, which was equally hilarious. But Tamil Nadu is a strange place in many ways. And I'll tell you why at a very macro level. It's got extremely good social indicators. You look at it, tremendously good social indicators, especially in areas like child nutrition, maternal health, all those things. There's tremendous empowerment of women there, right? I mean, the whole TVS 50 culture of women on mopeds was born there and really thrives there and everything else. And lots of women work. So it's a very progressive society from that perspective. Yet, its politics probably goes back to the Stone Ages. And I think the big picture here is the complete, which hasn't really come out anywhere because I don't think people understand the big picture. What you're seeing is the complete corruption of the Dravidian movement, which when it started off, there was one part which was anti-Brahmin, which means anti-ritual, anti-caste, anti-everything else. It was extremely focused on women's empowerment, rationality, and science, and things like that. So if you look at early days of the Dravidian culture, children who were born in those days were named like Gagarin and Marconi and Livingston and things like that, right? So some of them were also named Lenin and Stalin. But the fact is, you look at these names, and you'll realize why these children have those names, because it was a move away from the whole culture, which was then driven by the Brahmins, who've never been a majority in Tamil Nadu. Back then, at the peak of the Dravidian movement, or at the start of the Dravidian movement in the 50s, they must have been close to 15-20%. In the 60s and 70s, it came down to around 8-9%. Now it must be even lower. But the fact is, everyone did what the Brahmins did, which was to name children after gods and goddesses. But here was this wave of rationality coming through. But over a period of time, I think this movement has got corrupted so much so that it's become very ritualistic, contrary to the progressive tenets of the early leaders of this movement. They've started believing in personality politics and hero worship. That's what you see has happened here. And so you had MGR, and then you had Jayalalitha after him. And then after Jayalalitha, you have a lady who has no political experience, no political backing, nothing at all going for her except the fact that she was Jayalalitha's constant companion for so many years. I think it's the most obnoxious display of power grab that I have seen in recent times. Also because her own relatives who were dismissed and expelled from the party by Jayalalitha have now been brought back just because, you know, she claims that they apologized. And I see no reason why elected representatives have to put up with this kind of nonsense, because there is no other word to describe what's happening. So I have nothing against her, but the fact is, she is not elected. Just because you were part of a kitchen cabinet doesn't mean you get to come and run the show. You have to be elected. You have to prove yourself. And this level of personality politics and hero worship, you know, people all falling at first Jayalalitha's feet and now it's Shashikala's feet and other things. Actually, I haven't seen anyone fall at her feet, but I'm sure that's just a step away. That has to stop. So that whole thing is a mess. which is strange in a very industrialized society with high education, high social indicators, and both the education and the social indicators are the result of early Dravidian parties' policies of affirmative action and things like that, which really helped the state in many ways. So it's completely moved away from that. It's also a state that is now in significant agrarian distress. The northeast monsoon has failed. There's a drought in many parts of the state, and I think everyone should be focusing on that. Unfortunately, this whole drama has taken center stage. But a new chief minister is now in place, although he's been put in place by Sashikala. I'm hoping that over a period of time, he realizes that he can be his own man and that he doesn't need to listen to her because she has nothing going for her. I mean, I don't see her having a single redeeming characteristic which should make him say that, okay, I need to have her support. I mean, he needs to go out and be his own man. That's what you need to see.
Those were Sukumar's top stories for this week. Do let us know what you think. You can email us at feedback@lifemint.com and also tweet to us and let us know on Facebook. Thanks for tuning in. See you next Friday.